one of the stakes does make a difference in this world of ours, and that is going to be the focus of the second half of our show today. Very pleased and excited to have environmental activist Janie Chase on the program. She's doing a lot for environmental education of our children and climate change awareness, and she's also a fellow waste prevention nut like I am. But equally excited to have our first guest today, and that is Dr. Andrew Guzman. If you haven't heard him in an interview promoting his new book, Overheated, you will want to stay tuned because he talks about the human costs of climate change in terms that everyone can relate to. So very pleased to have him on the show, especially on short notice. He's a busy guy in demand. Also a busy guy, D.R. Tucker, who has a day job, but when he can, he takes time out to join us on the Green Front. And I'm pleased to say he is with us for the first interview with Professor Andrew Guzman. I'll give a formal introduction, but he really is quite the expert on climate change, despite the fact that he's a professor of law, director of the Advanced Law Degree Programs, and associate dean for international and executive education at Berkeley Law School, otherwise known as Bolt Law School, University of California, that is. He holds a JD and PhD in economics from Harvard University. He's written extensively on international trade, international regulatory matters, foreign direct investment, and public international law. That's a mouthful. All of that to bring me to the question. First of all, welcome to the program, Professor Guzman. And what got you to write about climate change?
Well, thanks for having me on the show first. Happy to be here. There's two answers to that question. The first one, why I'm writing on it at all, is it's the most important threat internationally, globally, that we face this century. Seemed like something I should be working on if I pretended to be an international law professor. I liken not writing about climate change to being a national security expert in 1939 and not interested in Nazi Germany. But, you know, this is the threat of our age. Why I wrote this book is actually I intended to write something that would have been much more like an academic project, but I came to be convinced that the most important thing that's stopping the United States from taking action on climate change, meaningful action, is that I don't think people appreciate how big the problem is. That is, how fundamentally it's going to affect the way we live. So I found myself pushed into writing this book, which is a book about how climate change is not simply a science problem, but also a social problem and a problem of how we relate with one another, how our social institutions work, and how climate change is going to sort of upset the apple cart of a whole variety of ways in which we run our lives.
I know my co-host, D.R. Tucker, could not agree more.
Definitely. Professor Guzman, this June is going to be 25 years since Dr. James Hansen addressed the United States Senate about the risk of climate change. Does it shock you, or does it depress you, or does it horrify you, or maybe all three, that in 25 years we've seen essentially a grand total of nothing coming out of our Congress and out of our political and media institutions regarding, you know, an intense focus on this issue?
I think that's right. I think I guess I'll pick was distress one of my options, if I can pick that one.
Sure.
I think it doesn't say anything good about our political system, though it's not like other countries have rushed to the forefront. Europe's done some things. It's perhaps a testimony to how big the problem is and how hard it is to wrap your arms around it. But this problem has been clear for a long time. And we would like to think we have a political system that responds to problems, imperfectly perhaps, but at least responds. And we haven't had that so far. And so hopefully we're getting there. Hopefully we're getting to the point where we can actually take serious action.
If you could take us through, perhaps summarize the accounting of the number of people worldwide that climate change is expected to impact, lives being affected in terms of refugees, perhaps lives lost, you really show how quickly it adds up to, you know, millions of people on this planet being, you know, in some way affected, and the math quickly adds up.
It does add up very quickly, and in fact, the most direct way to get there is to look at who's going to be affected by just one consequence, which is the shrinking and ultimately disappearing of mountain glaciers. And here's an example of how we don't appreciate how important these natural structures are. So mountain glaciers are critical to lots and lots of people because they capture precipitation during the rainy period and freeze it as ice and snow. And then they release it as meltwater during the dry period. And since we need water all year round, we need some tool, some technology to store the water. And we don't have the capacity to build artificial storage devices, water towers and things like that, reservoirs, in anything like the volume we need. So mountain glaciers do this for us, and they've done it forever, ever since we've had stable communities, 15,000 years or whatever that is. And they're disappearing. And what that means is all over the world, not millions, but billions of people are going to find the value of the water they're getting reduced. That is, they're not going to get water in the dry season when they need it, and they're going to get more flooding in the wet season. And if you look at where the glaciers are, and you look at where they produce rivers that, that people use, you're talking about something in, on the order of one out of every two people on the planet are reliant on this water. So when the water supply or the usefulness of the water contracts, that means half the world's population is suffering a water crisis that is more acute than what we've seen in the past. So the numbers do get very big very fast, and that's, you know, then from there you get to everybody on the planet, because one of the many consequences of this water crisis is agriculture is no longer as productive and yields fall, and so food prices go up for everybody. So, and that's, you know, you can pick, that's the most dramatic one perhaps, but you can pick just one example of climate change's natural impact and very quickly get to the consequence for human beings where you can't find a person who's not going to be negatively affected.
And if it isn't not enough water, it's too much water. The cover of your book has a picture of flooding and a wrecked home in the flow of water where it shouldn't be.
That's right.
Did you know about what the cover would look like? Obviously, your book came out just a couple months after Superstorm Sandy. Did you change the cover? Was that it all along? Are you one of those prophets who saw this coming, but perhaps not even as quickly as it has arrived in this country?
Well, so very much the last thing, not that I'm a prophet, but that I didn't get it as quickly. So the book talks about all kinds of global events, but also events in the United States. And, you know, you don't write a book without thinking about the readership. And so I was very interested in New York City in particular, because New York City is so central to the United States. It's such a, it speaks to the American experience in ways that no single other city does. And so I did a lot of research in New York. And at the end of the day, New York doesn't appear as a big player in my book, because there weren't effects on New York that were stark enough and easy enough to describe in ways that seemed credible to be included. And it occurred to me at some point that New York could be hit by a hurricane, and I understood the possibility. But I didn't think I could write it down in a way that would seem credible. I was always cautious not to seem like I was overclaiming. So the book goes to press. It's, as you say, it's less than 2 months from being out. It's out of my hands. And then Hurricane Sandy hits. It doesn't appear in the book. The cover photo is, in fact, from Hurricane Sandy. That was the extent to which we could include it. But it shows that even in a book where I'm trying to make the point of how serious this problem will be, and hopefully doing so accurately, the reality outstrips the book within months.
It's amazing. Professor Guzman, there is a quote-unquote news network broadcasting out of New York that has pushed for the idea that climate change is a hoax, and when they're not doing that, they push for the idea that taking action on climate change will somehow affect economic growth. What is your response to that? My response is always that the whole point of taking action on climate change is because climate change itself will be the threat to economic growth, not efforts to mitigate carbon emissions. But what is your response to those two tropes from the denialist community?
Sure. Well, so I think I agree with you that they're two different things. So let me do talk about the second one. It's true that addressing climate change won't be free. We benefit from being able to emit greenhouse gases without paying for that today. Right? We're putting that price on future generations. So reducing that emissions is going to cost us something. I think it's a pretty familiar economic principle that the user of a resource should pay for it. So this is very much in keeping with classical economic notions that we shouldn't push the cost on someone else. The longer term question, it's pretty clear that climate change will have a negative impact on economic growth, because it will affect productivity, which is in the very long term ultimately what drives economic growth. It will have a negative effect on productivity. So it's not as if it's just a stark choice between paying and not paying. It's a question of how we're paying. And climate change is going to make us poorer in a way that I don't think mitigation mitigation efforts will. But on the question of denials in general, I wish I could say that the right thing to do is just ignore them because it's so clear that they're wrong. The evidence is so powerful. But unfortunately, the denial industry is persistent and pretty good at marketing. So my suggestion, people are busy. They've got lives. Most people don't want to spend the time to become expert in this, and why would they? They've got other things to do. But in 10 minutes, you can figure out what you believe, which is, here's my recommendation. Identify a university you take seriously that you think is an elite university, and it doesn't much matter which one you pick. Go to their website and search for the words climate or climate change or global warming or anything like that. And what you'll find is whatever corner of that university is interested in these problems. And you won't find anybody at that university saying climate change is a hoax, it's not happening. That is, the people who know the most about climate, the scientists who are doing it, are all in agreement. There's no debate in that community. So the idea that somehow there's this big question is just not true. And you can go straight to the source, thanks to the internet, in a few minutes. And you'll see that they'll be having debates, but they'll be having debates about questions that assume and take for granted that climate change is happening, it's man-made, and that it's a serious problem.
And yet, while the human costs continue to grow in terms of extreme weather impacts, just look at 2012 to count up the billions, the only thing that perhaps is a higher number is what the fossil fuel industry is investing in spreading confusion and doubt on the climate science and silence. Do you think that can be overcome, in the near term? Climate scientists say we have 2 to 4 years to turn this around, and they've been saying that for a year or so. So every day is critical, and that's where I think some of us have our heads exploding when we look around and see that they're still being effective, the Koch brothers and all of the denial institutes that they're funding. And it's only the future of the planet at stake for the benefit of relative few, financial benefit, period.
Well, I think you fit on exactly the critical problem, which is the timing issue. It's clear that there's no doubt that the political system will eventually appreciate that they need to do something about climate change. And we see that because we had, the historic droughts, a historic drought last year, hurricane, highest average temperatures on history. All these things add up. But there is a deadline, and it's hard to figure out exactly when it is, and it depends on how we react. But every year we wait, the hole gets bigger. And there's a point at which it becomes hard, it just gets harder and harder to fix. And I think you're right. I think that's the most distressing part, in a way, is we can't wait. It would be best if we didn't have to wait for the political system to respond to a problem that is universally acknowledged by people in the scientific community, and where there's a relatively broad consensus on what we need to do that is basically either a carbon tax or a cap and trade system. There are differences between the two of them, but those two seem like the dominant strategies. And it's a shame that we can't get our political leaders to actually do it because, as you say, the clock is ticking.
Professor Guzman, you mentioned the carbon tax proposal. What do you make of the proposals by in the Senate, Senators Barbara Boxer and Bernie Sanders, and in the House from Congressman Henry Waxman and Congressman Herb Blumenauer to put forward a carbon tax? Betsy and I are members of the group Citizens Climate Lobby, which has been advocating for some time for a federal carbon tax. Do you think that, is there any hope, however slight, that there might be one or two Republicans somewhere with enough that can screw up enough political courage to support this sort of thing, or do you think this is going to sort of drown in a partisan swamp, basically?
I like to try to be optimistic about things. It's hard for me to see a situation in which that such a thing can get through. I think the Barb Boxer, Bernie Sanders proposal is fabulous. I think it's exactly the right kind of thing, just what we should be doing. You have a carbon tax, which obviously raises revenue, and then at least some of that revenue gets refunded to people so that the impact of the taxes on human beings is reduced a little bit. You have good effects on fossil fuel use while at the same time reducing the pocketbook costs on people. I think that's all great. Ultimately, that's the solution we need. I don't have any – I would bet a lot of money that it's not going to get through the current Congress. I unfortunately feel like the odds of us having a Congress that's more friendly after 2014 are not that great. I think in the short term, the real hope is from the president and the EPA, who have the power to regulate greenhouse gases. That's not the first best strategy, but it's an available strategy. And so hopefully they will get to that, and they will do it seriously, and they will do it in the near future.
One of the interesting points that you made in a recent talk to the World Affairs Council was how, you know, even though we've heard predictions of there, you know, going to be millions of climate refugees, environmental refugees around the world, really it's not refugee in the classic sense, and that, you know, it's not like they're going to be able to return to their home once the crisis passes.
Right. And the dominant form of, not the only kind of refugees we've had in the 20, we had in the 20th century, but the ones that have the most salience that we focus on and that are in large number are people who are refugees as a result of conflict. There's lots of conflict in the world, and people rightly flee that conflict. So we try to, at least when we're doing a good job, when we're being humane, we try to provide those people with some way to survive until the conflict quiets down and they can go home, which is a really terrific strategy for conflict, because it's far easier to resettle somebody where they come from, where they're likely to be in an ethnic community they belong to, where they know the area, where they have roots, where they have family, than to try to take them somewhere different. But climate change isn't going to work like a conflict. It's going to, especially with rising seas, it's going to take the land away, or with drought, it's going to make the land just not habitable, at least not by subsistence farmers and the kind of people that in many contexts will be displaced. So we're not just going to have a kind of refugee or displaced person crisis on a scale we've never seen before. We'll have that, but we're also going to have that crisis in a context where the most successful strategy we have for dealing with displaced people will not be available. And we just don't have a useful menu of ways to deal with those large numbers in any other way. So it's, they're going to have nowhere to go, and it's not imaginable that political systems will allow these people to be resettled internationally in the kinds of numbers that will be required. So we're going to have climate refugees in huge numbers with nowhere to go, and with all the bad consequences of being displaced in that way, which means famines and death from illness that can be avoided, and violence and things like that.
Professor Guzman, I just want to jump back to the point you made about President Obama having the ability to show leadership through the EPA. President Obama also has the ability to show leadership based on his decision regarding the controversial Keystone XL pipeline. Do you believe that he will, in fact, say no to it, or do you think that he's going to yield to the enormous political pressure from the fossil fuel lobby, from Republicans, even from some red state Democrats, to say yes to it?
Well, you know, they say prediction is a difficult thing, especially when it's about the future. I hope he says no. I think he's going to say yes. But I don't hold myself out as particularly expert on that prognostication of that sort. So I hope he's going to say no. I fear he's going to say yes. I think the pressures are very strong. We'll have to wait and see. He's in some sense, there's a sense in which he's well positioned because he doesn't have to run for re-election, because he's put his reputation on the line as wanting to do something about climate change. But even that may not be enough in the face of the kinds of pressure he's facing, or opposition he might face.
Mm. Professor, because DR has a lot of libertarian friends, or used to, as he's grown more passionate about raising awareness about climate change and the need for government action, because this is such a huge problem, perhaps the number of friends is diminishing. But, you know, you talk about the need for, you know, national policy, and also at the same time the need for individual citizens to do as much as they can to conserve energy. Why are both critically important, and no time to delay on either front?
Right. Well, let me say first, I've never entirely understood why a problem like this is not a problem that conservatives, I'm not sure about libertarians, maybe, maybe not, but conservatives don't embrace, because the notion of conservatism is an attempt to preserve some version of the status quo, that is a reluctance to seek change for change's sake, and a concern that change might create more problems than it solves. Well, the idea of preserving the climate is a deeply conservative notion, that we would protect against kind of an uncertain climatic future. So let me throw that out just as a precursor. I think the ultimate solution here needs to come from federal indeed international efforts, but federal policy in the United States, because we need people to change their behavior. And though people are capable of doing things for the public good and doing things they think are required of responsible citizens, I don't think we can get the kind of change we need without the use of tools that implicate people's self-interest. It's hard to stop people from burning fossil fuel when it's so easy, when it's so affordable, and when it has such a big impact on what we do, you know, driving our car when we want to drive our car, heating our home the way we want to heat our home. So the federal thing, the federal action, I think, is essential, because we need to raise the price of carbon, which then has all sorts of good effects on behavior, on the appeal of renewables, and so on. That said, it is helpful and useful for individuals to engage in individual action to attempt to reduce your carbon footprint. And there's lots of ways to do that, because there's lots of ways we produce carbon. So as you said, you know, heating and cooling your house more moderately is an obvious one. Driving less, if you're buying a car, buying a more fuel efficient car, and so on. So there's, you know, none of these are especially surprising. We kind of already have a good sense of what it is we do that is burning fossil fuels. So it is good for people to moderate that use. It's not ultimately the solution to the problem.
Professor Guzman, one of the issues that Betsy and I often discuss is the lack of significant media coverage of the climate crisis. Do you have any hope that this situation may turn around in 2013? Betsy and I were enthused by the recent announcement that a true climate hawk, Chris Hayes, now will have a weekday show on MSNBC. But we also have the news about, you know, the New York Times shutting down its green blogs, and the Washington Post transitioning out a great climate reporter, Juliet Elperin, to a general political news cycle. Do you think that we're going to see better or worse climate coverage from the American news media in 2013?
So here I do think I'm optimistic, hopefully not wrongly. And I think actually the more important source forum for news is not in environmentally focused media or sections of the media. It's the front page of the paper. It's the nightly news. It's, you know, the most central news, because the message has to be delivered to a broad audience that is not focused on this issue, people who have lots of other things going on in their lives. Unfortunately, nature is making that easier. We have a national drought. We have ever higher temperatures. We have big storms. So one way in which nature is telling us to do something is going to make it into the media. And you saw this after Hurricane Sandy. The media was making the connection between that and climate change, and they made the connection between the drought. And there was a brief period when it was confirmed that 2012 was the hottest year on record, where that made the news. So hopefully it doesn't require a steady stream of bad climate news to get there. But we'll have enough bad climate news, unfortunately, that I think it will raise in the consciousness of the media. And I think it's true that the public is more aware now than they were 2 years ago of the problem, and more accepting of the problem, and more accepting of the need to do something. I think we're on the right path, but as Betsy said earlier, in a way, the crisis isn't just being on the right path. It's moving fast enough down that path so that we take action sooner rather than later, because the costs of waiting are really, really high.
Mm. And you said in the World Affairs Council talk that you were trying to convince people like your own mother, who were busy with their lives, that this is important to them. Given the incredible human cost of climate change, you know, why do you think, besides extreme busyness, which is a cultural, you know, problem, you know, humans are so good at denying what is, as I call it, the green elephant in the room or all around us, and more evident than ever, and yet I still, you know, as I often say on the show, don't hear, you know, my fellow moms in, you know, Mill Valley, Marin County, Northern California talking about this issue the way they talk about where their kids are going to college, you know, what their plans are for the weekend. Just average folks don't seem to be still really putting this, you know, forget the top of their priority list, but even in the top three or five.
I think that's right. And I my sense is there's two things going on. One is the change in the climate, reported in terms of change in temperatures, doesn't seem that dramatic. It's a couple degrees Celsius, a few degrees Fahrenheit, depending on, you know, which numbers you want to pick, it's somewhere around there for most sensible projections. That doesn't sound like that much. You leave the house in the morning and it's more than 2 degrees Celsius cooler than when you come home in the afternoon. And it's not intuitive to us that the difference in climate is more, that difference in climate is much more important than the difference in temperature over the course of the day, that this difference in climate has all these bad effects. That's not intuitive to us. So I think that makes it easy to just say, oh, a couple degrees, I don't really care that much. The other thing I think is it's not a happy story. And it makes you feel a little, it can make someone feel a little powerless because the scale is so big. The whole world's climate is in trouble. You know, 7.5 billion people, or 7 billion people have a crisis. What am I supposed to do about that, right? There's this, there can be this sense of powerlessness, and, you know, one comforting reaction is to just push it from your mind and worry about other things that you can't control, like, well, I wish I could control my kids and where they're going to go to college, but you can at least try to control that. So I think it's those two things together, and we need a broader sense that something needs to be done, but because that something has to be done collectively, it has to happen through our political system.
We're just about out of time, but what DR and I are working on is trying to get a program dedicated, you know, to green issues, especially climate change, on some mainstream media outlet, because while the internet is great and far-reaching, and, you know, niche environmental blogs and websites are great because they attract the passionate eco-activists, we're not going to grow the choir unless we are appearing, being heard and seen someplace where just general folks tune in for their daily news or, you know, favorite political show on cable. So just so you know, we've been working on that for years, and we're hoping that that will be happening sooner rather than later, because these stories, while they are, you know, difficult and sometimes depressing, they're also kind of energizing and empowering and certainly important. So thank you for the work you're doing. Some of the smartest people come out of UC Berkeley, not just saying that because I came out of the journalism school there, and 25 years later I decided this was the biggest story that wasn't getting covered. It looks like you've done the same thing. So maybe you'll be teaching a course at Bolt about climate change, because you know what? There's no good law on a bad planet, right?
That's right. That's right. Well, I hope you are successful in getting your show picked up, because you deserve it. And I couldn't agree more with the importance of getting this.
Thank you. It's just because of guests like you that make me, you know, want to keep going, because you need to be heard. And next, you are going to not want to miss Janie Chase talk about empowering each other to do something to make a difference on climate change or composting and everything in between that you can think of on the screen. Janie Chase, right after these messages.